Thank you for joining me for another episode of Law and Religion Down Under, a podcast devoted to covering the interactions of law and religion in the South Pacific. Each episode features a guest from across the range of religious and political ideologies. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick. Our topic for today is freedom of religion in the Australian Constitution. Although the Australian Constitution is one of the few in the Western world without a Bill of Rights, it does contain an explicit guarantee of freedom of religion in Section 116. Yet, historically, the High Court has interpreted this provision quite narrowly. Recently, some scholars have argued that the court should interpret Section 116 according to a new method called proportionality. With me to talk about Section 116 is Guy Baldwin, a lecturer in law at the University of Manchester, and the author of a new article on proportionality and freedom of religion in the Australian Journal of Law and Religion. Guy, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wonder, for some of our listeners who maybe won't be familiar with sort of the ins and out of the Australian Constitution in Section 116, could you summarize just a little bit about what Section 116 says?
Yes, I will. But I'll start off with a quick apology that coffee shops don't open in the UK at this time yet. So if I make no sense, it's due to the fact that I haven't had any coffee yet. The wait until 8 a.m. here is excruciating for coffee, I have to admit.
Fair enough, and extra appreciation for doing this early in the morning from your time.
No problem. So Section 116, you said, protects freedom of religion. It has four different clauses, actually. I'll read out the section just for clarity. It says that the Commonwealth shall not make any law for establishing any religion or for imposing any religious observance or prohibiting the free exercise of any religion, and no religious test shall be required as a qualification for any office or public trust under the Commonwealth. So what I'm focusing on is the third clause, which says the Commonwealth shall not make any law for prohibiting the free exercise of any religion.
Okay,
it's very closely modeled on the First Amendment to the US Constitution, which very similarly says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting a free exercise thereof.
And one of the differences, of course, between Australia and the US is that in the US there are dozens and dozens of cases on freedom of religion, but here in Australia there's only a handful dealing with Section 116. Could you talk a little bit about the early cases where the High Court looked at freedom of religion under Section 116?
Yes, so the first case was Krieger, which was very early in the 20th century, and this case related to conscientious objection. So a person cited their religious beliefs as the reason why they couldn't undertake compulsory military service, even in respect of non-combatant duties. This case was given very short shrift by the High Court. Chief Justice Griffith essentially held that military service had nothing at all to do with religion, and therefore it wasn't prohibited, wasn't prohibiting it from a free exercise of religion, the claimant, that is. So the idea here seems to be that freedom of religion doesn't extend to people's conduct. It extends only to their internal beliefs, which is something that you see echoed in some of the early US case law as well, the case of Reynolds from the 19th century. But it's something that hasn't continued in that case law or elsewhere. So generally, it's not really considered that you can't manifest your religious beliefs within the concept of freedom of religion, and it's only extending to the holding of those beliefs. That's a very narrow conception of religious freedom. Then subsequently, in the 1940s, there was the case of the Jehovah's Witnesses, which related to the Commonwealth dissolving a group of Jehovah's Witnesses and taking possession of the premises of that group during World War II, pursuant to national security regulations. The idea here was that the group was prejudicial to the defense of the Commonwealth and the efficient prosecution of World War II because of certain preachings relating to the evilness of the British Empire and in fact, all political bodies. And the reasoning here that the court employed was very different from what we saw in Krieger. The focus of the analysis was on the non-absoluteness of religious freedom, so that it was possible to limit religious freedom if you had a good reason. And from the perspective of the court, the government had a good reason, or the parliament had a good reason for authorizing these regulations, namely protecting the country. And this was a sufficient reason to overcome the Section 116 objection in that case.
Now, I guess just a side note on that case, it My understanding is that Jehovah's Witness is still one, but on a non-Section 116 related claim. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. They did win on other bases.
Okay, all right. And then I guess we have to fast forward about 50 years until we get another important freedom of religion case in Australia, the Stolen Generations case.
Yes, that's right. So the next case is from 1997, and this involved a challenge to an ordinance from 1918 in the Northern Territory that empowered the chief protector of Aborigines to undertake the care, custody, or control of any Aboriginal or half-castes, to use the language in the ordinance, if in his opinion it is necessary or desirable in the interests of the Aboriginal or half-caste for him to do so, as well as to cause any Aboriginal or half-caste to be kept within the boundaries of any reserve or Aboriginal institution. So what does that mean? Well, essentially this was the ordinance that enabled the Stolen Generations to happen. Large numbers of Indigenous children were removed from their families. This has since come to be viewed as a very tragic event, but the issue was whether it was unconstitutional for this ordinance to have been enacted and for these powers to have been granted to the so-called Chief Protector of Aborigines. On that point, the ordinance was challenged on a number of different grounds, and I'm not going to cover all the different arguments that were made. Ultimately, the majority found that the ordinance survived the constitutional challenge. So the issue that I'm focusing on is the Section 116 challenge, which again wasn't given a huge amount of, it wasn't taken incredibly seriously perhaps by the court. The idea here was that by removing Indigenous children from their families, it was interfering with their ability to practice their traditional religious beliefs. And the focus of the analysis was on a new test that the court developed following the Dogs case, which some of the judges used a similar test in the Establishment Clause context, which focused on purpose. So it was quite different from the preceding two cases where purpose hadn't been the main criterion for validity under the free exercise clause of Section 106. So to give one example, Justice Gummo put it that under Section 106, the question becomes whether the Commonwealth has made a law in order to prohibit the free exercise of any religion as the end to be achieved. And the other justices adopted a broadly similar approach. The reason for this approach, according to the court, was the word for in the phrase any law for prohibiting the free exercise of any religion. And the idea was that textually this seemed to indicate that the purpose was the concern. Ultimately, the issue was found to be that there was no indication, at least on the face of the legislation, that this was a law intended to impair the religious practices of Indigenous people. And therefore, if you only consider purpose, and if you only consider particularly the face of the legislation, then you find that the legislation is valid. But in some ways, this is a very startling result, because what happened here was a very extreme interference, seeming interference with freedom of religion, because once you remove these children from their culture altogether, it's very hard to see how they could be free to practice their religion. So there seems to be a claim here of some substance that the court perhaps dismisses very readily due to the test that they have adopted.
And I guess since we have talked about the parallel between Section 116 and the First Amendment in the US, it's also not at all the test that prevails in the United States, which has a much more robust, I think, understanding of free exercise of religion than Australia does currently. And it's interesting from your just recounting the cases that if we have three cases in Australia, they've each had three different sort of standards for analysis. So the conscription case has a sort of belief action dichotomy. The Jehovah's Witnesses case has a sort of maybe balancing or sort of justification, government justification for overriding, as you say, a non-absolute right. And then the Stolen Generation case has a focus, it seems like 100% on purpose. What is the government's purpose? As long as its purpose was not to infringe free exercise of religion, then its actions are legitimate. So that's interesting, three cases, three different standards. And then now, today, in 2023, we haven't had a case really on freedom of religion in the High Court since. And I guess that leads to a lot of discussion in the sense of scholarship, academic discussion about whether the last word we have on freedom of religion, the Stolen Generations case, is the correct standard or whether there should be a different standard. And this brings up the concept, I guess, central to your article, proportionality. So what is proportionality?
So proportionality is a term that's been used in the constitutional law context in a number of different ways. But the conversation now is focused on the concept of structured proportionality, which is a series of tests that have been imported from Germany originally, but it's spread around the world quite a lot and is used in a number of different jurisdictions, including the UK and Canada and elsewhere. The test is often thought of as having four different stages. So I'll summarize it as it's been most recently interpreted by Chief Justice Kiefel and Justice Keane in the case of farm transparency. So the first stage is you are... Well, there's a pre, I should say there's this pre-stage that takes place before these four stages. The question of whether a law is burdened at all, a right is burdened at all by a law, or a freedom is burdened at all by a law. And then you ask the question, does the law have a legitimate purpose? And that's the first stage. And then there's a three prongs, a lot of numbers going on here. Sorry, it is a complicated test. There is a three stage proportionality assessment. So the first question in that three-stage assessment is the law suitable, which means that its measures are rationally connected to that purpose that was identified before. Then you ask, is the law necessary, which is largely a consideration of whether there's an alternative measure available that would be less burdensome or less restrictive of the freedom in question than the challenged law. And then the final stage, which is where a lot of the controversy exists, is the notion of the law being adequate in its balance, which might be viewed as a slightly clumsy translation of the German. And the idea is that a law meets the standard, is adequate in its balance, if the benefits sought to be achieved by the law, unless the benefits sought to be achieved by the law is manifestly outweighed by its adverse effect on the implied freedom. In other words, you engage in a balancing exercise between the benefit that the law is seeking to achieve and its effect on a freedom. And it's this balancing question that is perhaps a bit tricky. In terms of the debate that you mentioned about what might replace the Kruger test, I just wanted to add that I do agree with the scholars who have been critical of the test in Kruger, and for the reasons I alluded to before, that I think the notion that that we are compelled to focus on purpose because of the word for is an overly narrow reading of the word for. I think that it's quite possible to think of for as meaning something closer to with respect to. And Luke Beck has an excellent book where he talks about the drafting history of the Constitution and the complete lack of support for the idea that for was introduced to drastically narrow the provision. And I think, as you said, it is this approach of purpose is very inconsistent with the Jehovah's Witnesses case. It's also inconsistent with Prager, but I think Prager is not the right path. So the question arises, why depart from a case that was very carefully considered by all appearances and go off in this different direction? I also suggest that it's not the right focus from a moral perspective. That's a more complicated issue. But I think that the focus on justification that was shown in the Jehovah's Witnesses case is preferable. But as you say, the question then is, what test of justification, and is proportionality a good one? And I think what I've sought to show in this article is that although aspects of the proportionality test work reasonably well, some parts of it are more problematic. And my focus is particularly on the final balancing stage that I mentioned before, this balance between the benefit sought to be achieved by a law and the adverse effect that it has on a freedom. What I suggest is this is a kind of apples to oranges comparison. And without some kind of criteria or what's often called a covering consideration in the philosophical literature on comparability, without some third idea that can connect these two concepts, you can't really compare these two. And the question is, what is the third concept? What are the criteria that you're using to make this comparison? And the answer has to be the judge's own moral or political criteria. That there, if the test itself doesn't specify any way of engaging in this comparison, any way of doing this balancing, then it's coming from somewhere else. And what I'm doubting is whether this is an appropriate test when you're potentially striking down acts of parliament.
And that really does seem to be sort of the gist of the controversy, is that advocates of structured proportionality say this is a transparent, structured way for judges to be accountable for their decisions and sort of make it very clear why they're reaching the decisions they reach. And your counterargument to these proposals for proportionality are that it would sort of maybe empower judges or give them the ability to make decisions without adequate reference to, as you say, sort of external principles to justify their reasoning. It'd be more sort of policy preferences or personal views.
Yes, I think that's right. I think it's inevitably the case, unfortunately, due to the nature of the test. It gives a legal sheen to what is fundamentally a political question, which is whether the benefit of a law outweighs its effect on rights. I think that's a question that only Parliament can effectively answer in terms of how beneficial is this law? Is it worth it? This is a sort of very broad political question. Investing it in the courts is very unusual, to say the least. I think, as you say, advocates of structured proportionality point to its structured nature and its claimed benefits for transparency. I think it's clearly structured, perhaps almost inhibitingly so, because you have to go through all these steps, which I listed before, every time. I think some of the steps maybe don't add very much, particularly the suitability step, which I mentioned before, which requires that the measures that are impugned are rationally connected to the purpose that they seek to achieve. I think this adds very little, and scholars on proportionality have largely echoed that view that it's a low bar. Pretty much any law that isn't abusive would meet this standard. And if you have a law that is abusive, it would be caught by the later stages. So there's no real benefit to this aspect of the test. So what you have is a structured test that is in some ways engaging in a kind of very repetitive process in which the stages of the test overlap greatly. And you're going through the motions almost, doing these questions over and over again. And one doubts perhaps how useful that is, maybe as a way of demonstrating that there is a structure, but how useful is it if it's just repetitive and one of the stages at least has very little value add? In terms of the transparency claim, I think where this falls down is really at the final balancing stage, as I was discussing before, because the final balancing stage is not structured or transparent. It's this massive discretion that in some systems has been wielded very aggressively by the courts. And Germany and South Korea are good examples of systems where proportionality is used very aggressively at that final stage. And as I said before, without any criteria that link the two matters that are being balanced in this way, it's essentially a completely opaque discretion that's could be exercised by a court in any way that it pleased, based on how worth it they think that the law is as against its impact on a right or a freedom for that matter. So I think the transparency claim doesn't make that much sense to me, because although it's true that there are stages of analysis, you have to look at the actual content of the analysis. You can't just say, oh, because there are stages that this takes place over, that makes it automatically good. I think that's not the level of rigor that we need to apply to this test. So in the article, I do discuss some of the debate, and there are certainly views that suggest that the problem with the final stage is perhaps unavoidable, is perhaps not that alien to the judicial function. I guess what I would say is that the context is very significant, that this is constitutional law and it's striking down acts of parliament. So even if we might accept judicial discretions in certain contexts, we should be wary about granting such an enormous discretion in the constitutional law context. And also question, is this an improvement relative to a test that focuses only on that necessity question, which I mentioned before, that focuses only on what I call, or what others have called, means end analysis, that looks at the connection between the end that sought to be achieved and the way that the law achieves it, and asks, is this reasonably tailored, or is this appropriate and adapted, or whatever language you want to use? And the necessity stage of the proportionality test does precisely this. It looks at whether there's an alternative measure that, with regard to the purpose being pursued, is less restrictive of the freedom than the impugned provision. So my suggestion is broadly drop the other stages of the proportionality test and use this necessity question, which it seems as though everyone agrees is a completely legitimate question for a court to be asking. Why bother with the more controversial aspect of the test being the final stage, or the more superfluous aspect of the test, which is the first stage?
And would your proposed means end analysis encourage that ideal of judicial restraint, less sort of unhindered discretion by the judges, or opaque decision making by the judges, that you see as the flaw with proportionality?
Yes, I think that it would encourage. I think the question of restraints is complicated, because as I'm sure you're aware, what judges want to do is not always dictated by the test that they apply. So it may be that you have a very deferential court applying a test of enormous breadth, and perhaps that's what we're seeing with the High Court at the moment. The proportionality gives them immense power if they want to use it. But if the mindset is still deferential, not in the sense of invoking deference as a distinct concept, but in the sense of not having as an institutional mindset an extremely aggressive approach to rights enforcement, then it may not make that much difference in practice. So I'm wary about saying that this will encourage judges to be more restrained. Certainly the necessity stage of the test is a powerful stage, and in some systems, such as the UK and Canada, it's the main stage at which laws get struck down. Or in the case of the UK, they don't get struck down, but there can be a declaration of incompatibility under the Human Rights Act. So it's an important stage of the test, and I don't think it will impoverish judicial review to focus on this stage and to drop the others. But what I suggest is that it addresses some conceptual and theoretical problems with the final stage of the proportionality test to do away with it. And it also perhaps addresses some risk, because even though the High Court at the moment is very careful, and I don't think is desperate to strike down laws unnecessarily, you never know what's coming around the corner. And having a good test in place is important, I think, to making sure that future judges, future courts don't take the law in the wrong direction. So I think you want these foundations, these conceptual foundations, to be strong to avoid the possibility of future problems. And the proportionality test in some systems has been used for judicial activism because of the level of discretion that it grants to judges. It can empower a very activist approach. In other systems, not so much. It does depend on other considerations as well. So it's certainly not a case that the test will dictate outcomes, but there is an association at least, and even scholars in support of proportionality have acknowledged an association between proportionality and activism in some systems.
So I guess maybe to provide a little bit of context, we should say that the High Court has adopted, to my understanding, structured proportionality in some other constitutional contexts, implied freedom of political communication. And I think recently Section 92, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And so I guess advocates of structured proportionality would say, well, I guess they'd identify a trend for one thing and say it's just natural for this trend to continue into the freedom of religion ground. And they might say, well, look, in these circumstances, there hasn't been a problem with structural proportionality. So why would there be a problem with freedom using it in the freedom of religion context? Would you disagree with that? Do you think there has been a problem with how the court has used structural proportionality in these other constitutional contexts? Or is there something unique about freedom of religion that you think would pose a greater risk, I guess, of the court going too far?
I think my critique is general. It's certainly not limited to freedom of religion. And the reason I'm focusing on freedom of religion here is that it hasn't been determined whether the court is extending structural proportionality to Section 116. As you say, it has been extended to the implied freedom of political communication in McCloy in 2015 rather, and more recently in the Palmer case, it was extended to Section 92 by a majority. In both these cases, there were furious objections coming from Justice Gordon and Justice Gageler to the imposition of this alien test, I suppose, for want of a better way of putting it, that's imported from German jurisprudence into the Australian context. And they've raised a number of objections that are quite significant and in some ways dovetail with what I've said. I think to say that proportionality has been a big success in those two areas might be wrong in two respects, but it continued to divide the court. It was imposed in McCloy by a bare 4-3 majority. It was imposed in Palmer in respect of Section 92 by a 3-2 majority. This hasn't been a project that's unanimous. It's not a Colin Whitfield, seven judges of the High Court all agree. It's a highly divisive project that's attracted continuing opposition. And it's clear from the case law that some judges view this as a wholly inappropriate change to the Australian law. So I think to say that it's been a success might be a mistake. It also hasn't been extended to some context. So it hasn't been, the court has deliberately not extended it in the context of the franchise and in the context of Chapter 3. So the court has drawn some lines and said it's not going there. In the context of Section 92, it's in some ways a little bit puzzling because the language of Section 92 is the language of an absolute standard with the phrase absolutely free applying to the trade, commerce, and intercourse between the states. And Shipra Chordia, before the Palmer case was decided, wrote a blog post making a sense of this point, that this is not the kind of standard that proportionality would usually be applied to, because proportionality is usually used in respect of qualified rights and freedoms, not the kind of absolute standard that Section 92 purports to provide. So there's a category error, possibly, or some kind of fundamental mismatch here, I think, in applying proportionality in that context. Interestingly, Justice Edelman's judgment in Palmer is very frank about the problems with the final balancing stage. He even says that the objections to the final balancing stage on the basis that this is a matter, these are questions better addressed by Parliament, he says it has great force. So he accepts that there are problems or potential problems. But from Justice Edelman's perspective, the benefit of this stage of proportionality is that it stops the legislature, it stops the parliament from, to put it colloquially, using a sledgehammer to crack a nut. So if you have a very trivial purpose, then, and you've got huge infringement of rights, this is what the stage is meant to catch. And particularly since it hasn't been the focus of a lot of analysis in the Australian context, perhaps it is being reserved for those exceptional cases, particularly at the moment with the language of manifestly, that the benefit has to be manifestly outweighed by its adverse effect on a freedom. This language of manifest outweighing suggests that the standard at the final balancing stage is being applied deferentially. But I think what I would say is that the concern about a legislature having or imposing a significant impact on rights that isn't justified by a purpose or sufficiently justified by a purpose is very difficult for the court to assess. It's not something that it can very easily figure out just how important the public purpose is or how important or significant the benefit is, and then weigh that against the rights, the impact on the right, rather. This is something that would be very difficult for the court to second guess Parliament on, even if it did feel that there had been this sort of sledgehammer nut situation. So my suggestion is that these cases should be let pass, basically because if there's no particularly compelling or coherent way for the court to engage in this analysis of the final balancing stage, then I think you have to put this in the too hard basket from my perspective. So that would be my response to Justice Edelman's concern, I suppose, in Palmer about why we need this final stage. But I think that we have seen some fragments by the judges of the High Court that the final stage is enormously controversial, that what has been imported into Australian law is highly contested elsewhere, even if there hasn't been a lot of debate in the Australian context, from the standpoint of criticism of proportionality. It's exceptionally controversial in the international academic literature. And I think that what you're referring to perhaps is the momentum that proportionality seems to have in the Australian context, and also the momentum that it seems to have globally in spreading to a range of different systems. But my answer would be, well, the fact that it's popular doesn't mean that it's good. The fact that it's catching on among judges, perhaps due to some kind of collective herd impulse or something, I'm not exactly sure what we're seeing, but it doesn't mean that the problems that have been identified in the literature are wrong. It just means that the judges are acting in this way for whatever reason, and it's perhaps misconceived, and it falls to us in the academy to identify the problems.
Well, I think that's an excellent point. And especially as you say, the decisions in the other contexts adopting proportionality were so narrow, 4-3 and 3-2, that one might say they're not on as secure precedental ground as Colin Whitfield with the apt example that you give. I guess as we start to wrap up, maybe my question is from a sort of practical perspective. Freedom of religion cases are few and far between, as we've seen. With the prevailing standard from the Stolen Generations case being a standard that it's hard to imagine a circumstance where a lawyer would advise their client to bring a freedom of religion claim because it'd be so hard, I think, to identify an argument that the Commonwealth is intentionally setting out to infringe someone's freedom of religion. Is this a debate that is sort of doomed, I guess, for lack of a better word, to be an ivory tower debate? Or is there some basis you think in the near horizon where the High Court really would have to grapple and answer this question, what test should be used?
I can't see anything coming through the pipeline, but perhaps I just don't have that much visibility. I would hope that there will be a future case that revisits Kruger, because for the reasons that I've given, I find the Kruger approach extremely troubling. It does limit the effectiveness of the of Section 116 of the Free Exercise Clause in the way that it's been interpreted. And that's really unfortunate, because as you said earlier in the show, there are very few express protections for human rights in the Australian Constitution. And to the extent that we do have them, they need to be given some kind of meaningful effect and not sort of read down to the point of complete ineffectiveness. As I said before, though, the effectiveness of a purpose test also depends on how it's approached. And the US also looked at, in the US, courts also look at purpose in the context of the neutrality test, alongside other questions of general applicability, for example. And they found purpose perhaps more easily than, or prescribed purpose perhaps more easily than the Australian courts, because they look at parliamentary, what I would call parliamentary materials, but obviously would be called something different in the US context, as they did on Lukumi. And they would look at the existence of differential treatment and use that as the basis for inferring non-neutrality. So I think a purpose test can be more effective than it has been in the Australian context, but I would still suggest that a purpose test is not the morally optimal focus as compared with questions of justification, which I suggest should be the main focus of the inquiry in respect of religious freedom. So what I would hope is that someone will bring a case in Australia at some point. I can only imagine what it would relate to. And there would be a reconsideration of Kruger, ideally in the light of the Jehovah's Witnesses case, which I think is a much more sophisticated and balanced treatment of the issue, and correctly identifies that the non-absoluteness of religious freedom is, or should be, the basis on which these claims are addressed. So to give one example, Chief Justice Latham, he referred favorably to a test of whether there was an undue infringement of religious freedom in that case. And Justice Stark, in some words that I focus on more in the article, wrote that the critical question is whether the particular law, as in this case, is reasonably necessary for the protection of the community and in the interests of social order. So that kind of language dovetails very well with the notion of a proportionality test sans the suitability and final balancing stages. So we just take the concept of necessity. And I would be hopeful that perhaps if the High Court picks this up again, they will look back at the Jehovah's Witnesses case a little more carefully and consider adopting some of the language there. But as you say, in the light of the Kruger decision, it'd be very hard to persuade anyone to bring a claim, because the case was just so incredibly narrow in its approach that it would seem futile. But perhaps the times are changing and there is a chance to have another go and see if the High Court changes its approach. And I do think proportionality, despite all my criticism, would be better than the Kruger approach, because it's at least a test of justification. But I'm hopeful that we can get something even better than proportionality. And what I would suggest is, if that approach were applied to the Kruger decision, you could at least argue that the outcome would have been different. It does turn on some factual difficulties with the case. So the case was reserved to the full court without certain facts being agreed about the impact on the religious practice of the indigenous communities that were affected. And that was quite unusual. I can only speculate as to why that was. But even in the absence of facts before the court, I would have thought that certain matters could be taken on judicial notice and certain inferences drawn in such clear circumstances where there was such a massive interference with these indigenous communities. It was just sort of, I suppose, obvious to a certain extent. And we have Justice Gummow saying the withdrawal of infants from the communities in which they would have otherwise been reared no doubt may have had the effect as a practical matter of denying their instruction in the religious beliefs of the community. So the court is very aware, and perhaps due to this purpose test, didn't feel the need to chase the point up in terms of judicial notice and inferential reasoning. But I think they have enough there that could have been taken on judicial notice, perhaps, to have at least considered making a finding if they applied a test of reasonable necessity. And that kind of test would focus on the availability of alternatives to address whatever end was invoked. And you might say that this ordinance had no end, no legitimate end, which is quite possibly the case. But even if you thought that it had some kind of legitimate end, like protecting the safety of children who need protection, this blanket approach, authorizing removals with such minimal safeguards that applied only to Indigenous children and so-called half-caste children, this couldn't have been viewed as reasonably necessary. So my suggestion is, had the court adopted the test that I'm advancing, there's at least a reasonable chance it would have led to a different outcome. And hopefully a future claimant will come to the High Court and try to get them to change the test. That's my hope.
I hope so too. And I think that's the one point of consensus I've seen in the scholarly literature on Section 116 is that the purpose test is not fit for purpose and needs to be changed to really give some effect to the constitutional guarantee. We will wrap up there. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. You presented a very clear and persuasive discussion of proportionality and alternatives to proportionality, and I very much appreciate it.
Thanks, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.
That's it for this episode of Law and Religion Down Under. I'll put a link to Guy's article on freedom of religion and proportionality in the show notes. I'll be back in 2 months with another episode. Thanks for listening.